we're going to be discussing the economic conditions and some of the forecasts of that. If we did a webinar back in July where we went through a lot of these things, so if you still have that, it can still be downloaded. We don't have time to go through things in the detail that we did at that time, but many of the same trends are in place. We'll take a brief look at the midterm elections and then figure out how dynamic inertia plays into that. And then a review of what's going on in the print business, and I think some very exciting things and some very interesting things related to the kinds of print businesses that are doing extremely well today, as I've actually visited some of them, and it took more than one visit, I'll tell you that. So that was good news. Some of the challenges that we have for the print business, and then I'll discuss the book. So let's start. And what better exciting way to talk about the industry and the economy than the value of the dollar? You've probably seen numerous stories about how the strong dollar is changing the nature of the economy and international trade and all that. But then when you look at it long term, well, it's not so strong after all. And I've always enjoyed people who complain that all other countries are manipulating their currencies except for the U.S. We would never manipulate our currency. We do something else called quantitative easing or something like that. So you see how this is playing out. This looks like a short-term rise. It could probably go on for another few months and then settle back because everyone is addicted to inexpensive money, thinking that it helps them. And how we got here, one of the reasons that it's rising is that the perception that the Fed is pulling back, not necessarily pulling back, they're just stopping their purchases. But I remember being scared on this chart around 2008. And from that time, their expansionary efforts of their balance sheet, not necessarily the money supply, doubled. And we're supposed to have all kinds of horrible inflation at this time because of it. Well, the money is just sitting in the banks, making them look better than they actually are, and it's also been a gift to pension funds and others who've invested in the stock market. Those studies that I've seen, about half of the rise in the stock market is attributable to buybacks, which is attributable to cheap money, which is then attributable to what the Fed is doing. And I've had a chart recently in What They Think showing the 10-year bond rates worldwide, and the U.S. actually looks attractive on that chart. There are many countries that actually have much lower rates, and I'm wondering if all the stuff going on these past few weeks is really just a rebalancing of those kinds of things, knowing that the Fed will eventually start raising rates, and people maybe starting to position themselves for that. But in the meantime, getting some bargains for what appears to be a pretty good deal overseas, until, of course, you adjust it for inflation. But Frank Romano loves to go on about me adjusting things for inflation and all that kind of stuff. Frank is here, by the way.
And he's been adjusted for
inflation. He's been adjusted for inflation, yes. This morning, there was only one cinnamon roll, one Danish, and one bagel, and then Frank came and blessed them. And then... I've used that one before on you, right, Frank?
You have.
Yeah, I have, yes.
he
couldn't make the cream cheese multiply, but all the grain products he's good at. Well, see him for dinner, by the way. Order one scallop and see what happens. All right, so employment, we keep getting the sense, gee, employment is getting better, but it doesn't really feel that way. Well, we're almost at the levels where we were prior to the recession, and when you actually adjust it for population growth, you get a totally different feeling, that we're about 6 to 8 million jobs short. This sluggish economy has been going on for such a long time that we are actually that many jobs short, and one of the ways that you measure that is something called the employment population ratio. And if this doesn't put you to sleep, I don't know what will, but you see, they take total employment divided by the total population. You see the number is down in areas that we hadn't seen since the 1970s and 1980s. And then this other area is growing called not in labor force. You've heard about people exiting the labor force for any variety of reasons. Some of them decide that, gee, I really can't find a job, but I've always had some kind of nagging industry injury. I do have a nagging industry already, but I know I have a nagging injury, and I'll see what I can do, find somebody who might qualify me for a disability, and they do that. Barron's had an article about that a few weeks ago, where if you are getting like a $1,600 disability payment, that's the equivalent of having about $500,000 in your IRA, when you look at all the payments over time, depending when you do it. So you can see the choice that many people are making as they seem discouraged in the workforce. Now to more happier things, buying stuff. Retail sales have been positive for a long time. You see, about 3 years ago, coming out of the bottom of the recession, they perked up. And this is inflation adjusted, and it seems to be hovering around the 2.5% mark, which is about where GDP is likely to be hovering. You saw that they had a revision. I know you watch all these things intently, like I do. You saw that they revised GDP to 4.6% for the second quarter, hoping that we forget the awful negative number for the first quarter. But on average, this is about where we are. One thing that's been positive lately has been the Small Business Index from the National Federation of Independent Business. It's been stuck for months and months and months between the bottom of the recession that we had in the early 2000s and the bottom of the recession in the early 1990s. And it finally started to break through. It's nothing to write home about yet, but it's finally on the right course. Having small business do well is really, really important, but not for the reasons that you probably think it is. All kinds of politicians love to talk about the increasing employment in small business as a way of stimulating the economy. But really, the entire economy has to be getting better before small business gets better. But there's a period of time when large businesses do not like to add staff or do not like to do services themselves. They're usually cut back a lot, and they start hiring small businesses to fill in the gap until they feel confident that they can do something. And that's why small business starts to perk up sooner. So we've seen some better news from small businesses. Now, to jump ahead just a little bit on some of the stuff in the book and all that, we really believe that small and mid-sized businesses are going to be critical targets for the printing industry and the way the printing industry emerges, not big corporations and the like, because small and mid-sized businesses have very, very significant communications challenges with their audiences, and now they have more choices than ever, ever before. In terms of what they can do, and what they can do within all budgets that they used to have. I mean, we're talking about businesses where their main advertising was going to be a Yellow Pages ad and a magnet on the side of their car with the company name. Now when you're in an era where you've got Facebook pages and vehicle wraps and store signage and all other kinds of things that the small businesses need, you have owners who have absolutely no time to get involved with these kinds of things and need to do them well and can actually see good results when they are done well, but they don't have the time for it. And that's going to be an important part of our industry going forward. Now, to get it back to GDP, we had a negative GDP in the first quarter, and everybody focuses on the quarterly number of GDP. I prefer to look on the year-over-year numbers because it tends to float around a bit, and these numbers get revised constantly. They're always presented in the press like they're final. They're never final. Every GDP number gets revised three times when it's released, and then once a year there's a revision that goes back for 3 years, and then even after that there are revisions that were labeled go back and change categories and go back 20 or 30 years like they did last year, when they added an intellectual property line to the GDP report. So they recalculated GDP back forever. So basically, in the statistics world, no decision is final, and we're going to change the numbers because we want to be more correct than ever, because if you don't have good data for 1977, you're not going to make good decisions today. And you know it, don't you? The Bureau of Labor Statistics issues a very, very interesting report once a year. Not many people know about it. It's a report about consumer spending. And with all of the political stuff you're about to hear, ads and all about the incomes going to the top earners and the bottom earners get nothing and all that kind of stuff, this is the only report that gives us a perspective on that that really, really makes sense. Because none of the other reports are in proper context. None of the income reports report things like transfer payments in their data. So if somebody is getting some kind of social assistance, it doesn't show up in the personal income report until you start looking at their spending and start calculating what total income comes in. So here's one where I wanted to compare 2 years that were rather stark, and it will give you a sense of why GDP is so sluggish at the same time. So these are 2008-2013 changes in income from this special report. And so why is GDP mired in this 2% range? Well, if you look at the lowest 20%, their incomes, including transfer payments, since that time are down 15%. And the next tier, these are broken into quintiles. So that means five for those of you from out of town. So we've got five little groups here, and they have the high end is the fifth. So you see how incomes are very, very different. Then look at the spending. I'll have another chart that summarizes this together for you. If you look at the spending, see they spend more in the lower quintiles than they have income in the higher lower quintiles. How do they do that? Well, it's called social assistance, transfer payments, social security payments, all interest from savings. That's another problem with the way economic data are reported in the press. They don't give you any context as to the groups who are involved in here, because in the lowest quintile, you're going to have college students who may be emancipated, meaning that they are on their own as far as for tax purposes are concerned. They may qualify for food stamps. They may have some savings that they're drawing on. They're in there just as much as someone on permanent disability, let's say from a car accident or something or other, who solely depends on transfer payments to have them survive. So it's really a very big mix. So we're looking at the top, but this chart will summarize it in numbers for you. The lowest 20%, their income is down 15%, but their spending is down 9%. And then you see you don't get into an area of anything positive compared to 2008-2013. These data, like I said, they're not reported by the press. The data are kind of complex when you look at them. They're not easy to present. I tried to present them carefully here, and I know it's still a blur, but it shows you that until the incomes start rising, you're not going to get a robust economy. And there really is nothing indicating that the incomes are going to rise in a very, very significant way. So our GDP forecast for the long term is still sitting in that 2.25 to 2.75 range with occasional bursts out of it. But for the long term, that's where we're sitting. And we are still well below the long term 3.3% since World War II. And eventually that average will start to fall as well as these years are in there. But essentially, we've had productivity going up for over 10 years and people not being rewarded for it in their paycheck because that money is being used for regulation compliance, increase the benefits cost, increase supplies cost, so the employees are basically seeing the same purchasing power they had or less. That's not very, very good long term. As far as inflation, I go shopping with Mrs. Webb often, but the more interesting trips are the ones where she goes herself and comes back with the stories. Because I have a habit of explaining things while we're in the aisle. Why is this price that? How come this one's cheaper? So when she comes home and says, it's really strange, but salmon is cheaper than beef or something or other, I said, well, you know, I explained that. Or, gee, this package shrunk again. Is that accounted for in the inflation data? Yes, they take care of all those things. Well, why does all this stuff happen? Well, I said, because inflation is not really what they're reporting. They keep telling us it's like 1.5% to 2%, but it's not, because this chart explains quite concisely and so beautifully, I might add, that it doesn't matter what the inflation rate is. If they're aiming for 2%, if incomes go down, because if incomes go down, even if inflation was flat, stuff would be more expensive. So you have this hidden inflation rate because incomes are low. So what's the real inflation rate on this chart? Well, I circled the last ones in red. It's averaging around 4% when you take into account how much the price goes up and how much the incomes go down. We're running at about a 4% level. Again, it's not reported that way because their job this day is to report on the release at 8:31, a minute after it comes out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then they go on to the next report. It's never put in any kind of grander context. And since I'm on my favorite topic of inflation, here are the multipliers based on August inflation data for the U.S., and these are the numbers that you multiply your financial statements by in order to bring them to the current value of purchasing power of the dollar. This really creeps up on you over time, so it's important to do it. If you're working on budgets and looking at 3 years of data, make sure you adjust your data, because you'll start seeing growth when there is none. You'll start realizing that the flat isn't flat, and that when you actually see growth, you're going to be seeing real growth that you may want to start adding extra resources to that once you have it in line with the rest of your business. Now this slide, I've been using this slide for 4 years. I'm going to keep using this slide because it's still the same way. We have a rather bad decision-making process that's embedded in the economy just because of the way things are. I'm not a fan of this uncertainty about the future stuff, because uncertainty is supposed to be where entrepreneurs thrive, so it's not that. I'm saying that the decisions that corporations make are not measures of uncertainty, they're measures of risk, and they're also measures of certainty, because they know what tax rates are for a particular period, and when we look at the political stuff, tax rates are not going to be changing. So they have that. They also know that businesses and new products have to be funded with negative cash flow for 3 to 4 years before they start showing anything positive. And when you start doing net present value on those kinds of things with even a small inflation rate, let's say you put in 3 or 4% plus the tax rates, you have to have projects that really are incredible to overcome all of those issues. So then a lot of them take the easy way out. They do the buyback thing, which is probably one of the most counterproductive things that that corporations can do. But Wall Street likes it, so they keep doing it. Because essentially, when you're involved with stock buybacks, you're saying, I have no other use for our money. There's no companies for us to buy, there's no technologies for us to develop, and that's what they do. So they try to please everybody. A little dividend here, a little buyback here, and then really not much else. The other reason they like the buybacks is that it increases the earnings per share. If that's how your bonus is calculated, you're going to do lots and lots of buybacks, as much as you can. And this is where we are. This is where we're staying. What does this mean for print? Well, what this means is that to cut costs, you're investing in digital technology. If the economy grows significantly and my forecast for GDP is wrong, what are you doing with the extra money? You're investing in digital technology. So if you get a hint, no matter what happens, you're investing in digital technology because it's a protection against economic downturn, and it also enables you to realize a greater profitability on the way up. So the bottom lines of this extremely exciting part of my presentation, right? Yeah, I've lost them already. Be wary of GDP data because it's not being confirmed by other data series. We're stuck in that 2.5% trend. The unemployment rate will keep getting better because more people will continue to exit the labor force. And while I do not believe that we're headed for a recession with some of the stuff going on around the world right now, I think we're in that shape.
So if they were napping through that part, they're going to be able to download this presentation, right?
Yes, they will, because, you know, sometimes it's hard to sleep at work. So if you download and put it on your tablet before you go to bed, go through these first 20 slides, you'll be okay. You'll feel refreshed and normal.
But in the home office thing, you teach them how to
sleep. The home office, you can sleep anytime. All right, how about the elections? The phrase dynamic inertia is from a former boss of mine who's long passed, but he loved this phrase because you're essentially on a treadmill, working out really hard, sweating a lot, feeling good about yourself, but you haven't done anything, accomplished anything other than stay in the same place and sweat. I hate this time of year mainly because of the commercials. So this is a great time for DVRs. I love DVRs in October and November. The governors are mainly Republican now. That's unlikely to change, but there's 27 up for election and 14 are considered toss-ups. When you throw all the toss-ups into whatever one has the slightest lead, you look like you've got the same place. The governorships are important in terms of the economy because most all states, I think except one, have balanced budget requirements. So that's where a lot of action occurs, that where discipline occurs, where it doesn't occur in the federal side. On the House, if the Republicans lost every election, they would still have enough seats to control the House, so there's not going to be any real change there. One of the things, of course, is to watch the Senate. Some of the forecasts I've seen are forecasting a shift in power in the Senate to 52-47 and 1, which would be a two-seat majority. I have not seen any reports of a 50-49 and 1. The one is independent Bernie Sanders, who caucuses with the Democrats. I haven't seen anything like that. I think that that might actually be possible. We had that before, after the 2000 elections. It's not a particularly good thing to have. Some people would say, well, if they're deadlocked, they can do less damage to us. But, you know, if you let enough problems fester after a while, everybody is damaged by that. There were articles appearing over the summer. This one in the Wall Street Journal was important. One of the ways that there's been gridlock in Washington was by refusing to have things come to a vote on the floor. That's one reason why technically budgets haven't been passed for over 4 years. I know they didn't pass one so they wouldn't have to have a shutdown, but it was really mild and nothing was decided in it. And we're funding the government based on continuing resolutions as opposed to real budgets. And this is the way they're doing it. They're only having votes when they absolutely have to. The Democrats running for re-election have been upset that they have no votes on the floor to point to or no legislation that they say they brought to the floor for their campaigns. They've only had 7 votes on 676 Democratic amendments. The Republicans were luckier. They got 11 out of 812. And the comment in the article was that none of the 9 Democrats elected in 2012. So these are basically new seats. And if the pattern holds, then anybody who comes with an anxious ability to change Washington or make things better, they're not going to get anything on the floor to vote it. So they're going to be very, very frustrated by that. So this is my forecast that the Senate and House are in Republican control. I'm less certain about the Senate. You do know you're going to have a lame duck president, and we're just going to be mired in this inaction, but lots of gnashing of teeth. The Affordable Care Act will end up being protected. There'll be no action on tax reform, and you're going to see executive orders and regulatory actions just flying out of the White House once the election is over. So you may get some interesting Supreme Court challenges, but really there's not going to be much change in anything there. So I found making politics can be just as depressing as some of the other stuff. So let's look at a new way of our new perspective of printing shipments. I'm going to go through some history here. Some of it is nice. Some of it is interesting. Others of it will tell you why I'm called Dr. Doom. Now, if you remember how Dr. Doom started, was it 16 years ago? No, 15 years ago. It was in 1999, where I was at a podium at Trendwatch Breakfast. Remember the Trendwatch Breakfast? I'm still in touch with my business partner, Jim Whittington, is doing well. And I said at that event, we're going to call 1998 the good old days. And then the Dr. Doom stuff started. Was Joe right? Yeah, he was. All right. But I entered the industry at a very, very interesting time, in 1978. That was my entry here. But during this 20-year period, the average consumption of commercial print, adjusted for inflation, so we're looking at the same dollars, rose by 80%. And the reason for that was the shift to digital technology in the business changed our cost structure, even at the time of the deepest recession in the late 1970s, early 80s, when you had to pay 22% on a lease to buy a color scanner, which cost $300,000, which in today's money is somewhere around $1.2 million. And you could make money at that in those horrible, horrible economic conditions. Photo typesetting was also a main reason for those changes. So everything we did to go to press left the craft and went into digital. Not that digital is not a craft, it's a different craft. But that's what happened there. So during that period, we also had press advances, and we had an explosion in process color, which changed the perspective of the use of print, because advertisers and others learned that you could have 30 to 40% increases in response just by using process color. It was a big, big change. If any of you are in a house for a long, long time or never throw anything out, and you find a magazine from around 1978 and then also find a magazine from 1982, it's a night and day difference between the two of them. Then there's this little period, and it's odd to think of it this way, but when you look at the data on a per person inflation adjusted basis, I now call it the Great Stagnation. The peak consumption of commercial print was in 1995, when it went up to $540. That also happens to be the year, and I keep going back to this one, is the IPO of Netscape, which is now buried somewhere in AOL. Is AOL still around? Yes, they're still around. Barely. And that's when the internet started to come to prominence among consumers. So this was also a marvelous time to be a commercial printer, because all those dot-com companies had lots of money that they were spending on promotions. We had this idea that the dot-com companies would be spending money on printing forever. Profits rose. You're going to see a profit chart that's rather incredible. Profits rose dramatically at this particular time. But the seeds of the change in media were being sown at that point. And then when we look at 1999 to 2007, one of the biggest issues here was the introduction of broadband, because the other stuff was dial-up. Dial-up was cute, and it was noisy, so everybody knew when you were online. But broadband, when you start adding video and other kinds of rich media and streaming media, and your experience changes significantly. It becomes almost a pleasure to be online and use media. At that point, e-commerce really took hold across all age categories. Older, more educated citizens began using it for vacation planning, investment management, and other things. So it wasn't just pictures of grandchildren that were going around. I mean, they were really starting to get involved in having the internet as a regular part of their day. At the end of this period, two other big changes. The iPhone comes out. Not that Nokia couldn't make a phone like that before, but there's always something special when Apple does it. And social media began. Now, social media actually began a little while before that, but it wasn't until around this time that Facebook and Twitter got into everybody's vocabulary. So during this time, we went from about $530 to $392. Then we're in the era that we are now, where you have over 70% broadband penetration. You have the iPad and other tablets coming around 2010, and the numbers of social media and technology owners is just absolutely staggering when you get there, considering how short a time that was. Hidden behind all of these things is cloud computing. There was cloud computing before, but now people are realizing what it is, and one of the reasons is that the drop in costs in storage has been really incredible. And with all the broadband around, You can access numerous kinds of data for that. And of course, one of the biggest players in this is Amazon. Amazon Web Services is, I can't believe the number of websites that are used by that. But if you look in the corner when something's loading and you start seeing AWS in the corner, everything is being hosted by Amazon, including Dropbox. So here's our chart. And from the chart, you can tell that we are now at levels of print consumption that are below the 1970s. People are getting information somehow. And this reality is finally hitting the strategy of print business owners. There was a period when they felt that they could hunker down. So they hunker down, they kind of hide, hoping that when they come out, the same marketplace would be there. But technology doesn't change while you're hunkering down. You have to really reconfigure your business, and some of the best times are when you should be hunkering down, typically. That's the time when you should be reconfiguring your business, looking for partners, looking for alliances, looking for consolidation. Now I think we're at a stage where you have to be looking at consolidation just as a normal course of things to expand the business. There's what I call a defensive consolidation that's been in the business for a while. Two companies in trouble kind of get together and figure out a way to stay out of trouble together. It's always good to stay with a partner when you're lost, right? Mom always told us, stay together. Right, that's what they're looking for. Here are our latest monthly printing shipments, and I threw 2007 and 2010 in here so you can get a feel for how the seasonality of the business changed, and this is proof of the media shift, especially on retailing. The years prior to 2007 always had extremely big fourth quarters, and it was mainly Christmas and other holiday printing. Back to school would be the predecessor to that, would lead up to a very, very nice September, and then October, and then November, and then a fall off in December, because many plants would shut down at the end of the month. The next line is 2010. And you see that the retail had slipped out. This is where March became our biggest month. And then somehow, in the government data, May became the biggest month, and that's starting to fall back a little bit. But the gray line is 2013, and the 2014, you see that we haven't had a month above $7 billion. And we had our first month below $6 billion. So we know that there's a shift here, but you have to look at a marketplace not just from the top down, but also from the bottom up. There's a lot of really interesting things happening on the bottom up. Among them are what happens in the PIA profit leaders. This chart shows the all printers' profitability, and it's usually bad. How can people be in an industry and make 2%? The next column is the profit leaders, the top 25% of the participants in the study. Those numbers are different in a very, very big way, usually around 9 and the low 10s. What's interesting, though, is even during a recession, they find a way to eke out a 7% bottom line. And the gap between the profitable companies and the unprofitable ones gets bigger. And that's where we lose a lot of our companies. We're still at the rate of losing 1,000 establishments a year. Actually, the number of establishments changes. We lose 3,000 and gain 2,000. Because what's happening is that the government is counting tax returns. So when you consolidate, you have two businesses basically shutting down their business, being replaced by one. And that's what that's showing. So there's a lot of heavy activity in the shuffling around of the ownership of print businesses, and it nets out as a loss of 1,000 establishments per year. But the gap between the profitable and unprofitable ones hurts a lot more now. If you are unprofitable in this environment, it's very, very difficult to sell your way out of it. So this is a prime time for consolidation, not consolidation among weak companies, but among stronger companies, companies that have some kind of upside or are developing new products for a much different printing business than we have today. How are these profits look like on an industry basis? Well, remember how profitable I said the 1990s were when shipments started to stagnate? That's the numbers all the way to the left. The industry was producing almost $17 billion worth of profits. Then we got our little ski slope, and we started to hang around the between $4 and $6 billion. And the red line is at the bottom of 2005, so you see where we've been from there. What's interesting about this, we're producing the same level of profits for a number of years, and think about 1,000 fewer businesses, and also losing somewhere in the range of 10,000 employees every year. So you end up with this chart, which is the profits per employee in the industry are now the highest they've been since the year 2000. So even all the negative numbers at the top stuff, you look at the things that are happening at the bottom line, literally, and then break it down into how many people are working in our industry. And you know that joke. How many people work at this company? Oh, about half. You've heard that joke. You can use that at work if you want. Why don't I repeat it again? Because some of you missed it. But almost, I mean, we broke the $9,000 per employee mark. That's a big deal. Because sales per employee are basically the same as they've been for years, about $175,000. But our profits are going up. So it's coming from a combination of efficiency and doing the right things. We're losing the companies that are very efficient at print production at producing the wrong things. That's one of the worst parts you want to be in. You never want to be an efficient company that produces stuff that people don't want. And that's what a lot of printers who are in trouble find themselves. So here's our forecast. Go up to 2020. We have two forecasting models. We actually have another one based on GDP, which is never really any good. But we have one model, what we call the conservative model, that puts our industry at about $45 billion at 2020. We have another model, the aggressive model, that puts it down at $7.6 billion. That's not a typo. That won't happen. Not while I am here. So my forecast is that will be probably in the 49 range in 2020. With healthier companies, with smaller companies, not because they're small because that's, you know, they've downsized. They're small because they have the right technology to deal with and sell to small and mid-sized businesses. And of course, you're going to have some large companies taking care of the rest of the market. But they're not going to be as high profile as they used to be, that's for sure. Now to the very, very laughable topic of industry demographics. I don't know how I can lighten this one up. Let me give a little history. Years ago, I used to work for the Graphic Arts Blue Book, which was a source of much of our industry data. Graphic Arts Blue Book and their database are no more. So we have to rely on a report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that they get from Social Security data. And that's fine. We like it because we know where it's comes from. It doesn't come from a survey. And if people don't participate in sending their information in, they go to jail. I like surveys like that. Guaranteed a high response rate, so I think it's good. So these are all data from the Form 941 Social Security tax that companies file depending on the size of their payroll. And it's published every single year. The latest data are from 2012, which isn't bad. The schedules actually come up because you used to have to wait almost 5 years to get these data. We run this through our forecasting models, and the 2014 data show that from 2012 to 2014, we've gone from about 27,500 to around 25,000 printing establishments of all types. And our forecast for 2020 is for it to go to 18,500. And I bring this up because you can't find these data very, very easily. And as our industry has changed in its relationship to gross domestic product, the Census Department has cut back on the categories that they report for us. They used to report on 10 categories. Now they're reporting, when you look hard at this, you realize it's only 4 categories. That won't stop a consultant in Excel. Because we have our forecast for the categories, some of the categories they stopped doing. See commercial litho decreasing from about 10,000 in 2012 down to about 6,800 in 2020. Digital printing going up increasing from about 2,800 to 3,900. And I looked at the ratio of litho to digital printing shops, and you see that that is contracting over time. The digital printing shops do not have to grow. They're going to grow in number, but the productivity that these businesses will be able to get from much of the new equipment that will be coming out in the next few years will mean that their employees' levels will not have to be increasing as much as it would for other kinds of technologies. So, with all of that behind us, you now know a place where you can come for data. I talked about this rather extensively in the webinar, so go look at the July webinar, and you'll get a sense of many of these things in more detail. But I'm pleased that I've been able to give you your good, reliable Dr. Joe presentation. You're leaving here filled with coffee and needing a Xanax. But I have something a little bit more positive to talk about, which is the new book and why we wanted to do it. I started to get the idea for this toward the end of last year, and realizing that Disrupting the Future was a good book, and I love that book absolutely dearly. I'm surprised I actually wrote some of that stuff, and then I realized, oh, Richard wrote it. But the way we collaborate is just terrific. So I'll describe this to you. I got the idea that we needed a new book because the market had changed, Disrupting had kind of run its course, and getting business was kind of okay, but we needed something to help individual print business owners get over the idea that they have to change their business, and not just give them reasons, but give them ideas about how to do it. And from speaking with them, we realized that one of the problems was they kept looking back at their business, because that's the business they knew. And whenever most small or mid-sized print businesses sit down to plan, the way they plan is they pull out their tax returns and some of their other budget data, they sit down with their accountant and they say, what did we do the past couple of years? So we wanted to try to find a way to break that, so they're looking at their business with some kind of fresh eyes. You have to acknowledge what got you to a particular point, but then how do you get from this point forward? So that's how we started the idea with the book. Then I started to make some presentations, and around the middle of February, is Joe Polanco here today? I don't know if you know Joe Polanco, who's the head of PIA Mid-America, who's responsible for Dallas and Kansas City. I did something I don't do unless I really, really need a favor. And I called Joe and I said, I have a big favor to ask you. I need you to let me speak for free. And I heard a thump on the floor. And I said, I told him I were working on, and he said, fine, I'll help out. So we made presentations to Dallas and Kansas City of the rough material for the book, and the people knew that we were in the process of working that. So they were very, very helpful in that. Those are two really, really good audiences. And he runs a really, really good PIA affiliate. And I would send the recordings and the slides and all that to Richard somehow after that chapters show up. And then he hears me rant on Skype, half an hour a week or something or other, and we work on things. And because we're seeing all of these kinds of data that we're not participating in. So let me lay some data groundwork for you. This particular chart shows publishing and advertising agency revenues. Okay? Where do you think the publishing lines are? That's right, the bottom. The newspaper industry is half of what it was in 2004 in terms of its advertising and circulation revenue. Magazine publishing has flattened out a little bit, but it's not what it was. And then basically miscellaneous publishing, book publishing and other stuff, that's flattened out. When you start selling e-books, you don't have the same kind of revenues. You don't have the same kind of costs either, but it may look like declining revenues, even though you might be selling more units. All right, so the advertising agencies have clearly readjusted their business. Good for them. They can do that because they don't have much capital investment that they have to figure out how to unwind. I mean, that's a person business, and the capital investment they have is mainly computers to enhance that. It's not production kind of stuff. So they added to their business social media and other kinds of digital production, search engine optimization, things like that. And you have this growing PR side of their business. In past years, I've always commented on how public relations employment has been going up. And it's still going up. It's going up somewhere in the range of 5% per year. And it's in part of the advertising data, so you pull that out, and you realize that something's happening with unpaid space. Now, that's the way we used to call it, what we used to call editorial. Something's happened with non-paid media, where you don't have to buy broadcast time, and you don't have to buy space in something on a billboard or in a print magazine. They're doing lots of other things. These folks are really, really into social media. One of the pleasures of my moving to North Carolina has been to be involved with the local AMA chapter there, and to hear the advertising agencies talk about what they're doing in social media and other things online for their clients and making money at is rather incredible. One of the speakers we had recently was Krispy Kreme. How many of you from the South know Krispy Kreme, right? And you know the emotional attachment that people have with that product. I'm a Dunkin' Donuts man, I'll admit that. But Krispy Kreme is something special in the South. They discontinued all of their print advertising, every last bit of it, and went for social media and the refurbishment of a big 1950s, 1960s bus that they bring to all different kinds of events around. And the print products that they're using are all in-store signage. They're really focused on that. Now, they did have a financial debacle where they had to throw in a CEO for stock fraud kind of stuff a few years ago. So they've been rebuilding the company. They are just thrilled with that strategy. No more coupons, no more ads, no more TV ads, just mainly social media and coming up with wacky holidays to give you a cup of coffee and a donut for free to build the store traffic. That's really working well for them. And you hear other examples like that there too. Internet advertising is still growing, 18% a year. When you take out mobile, it's 12% a year. When you add mobile back, mobile's still doubling every year. So you see how that is playing out. We found this picture, which basically is describing my iPhone. We don't know who this person is. We found this online. We'd like to find them. We'd even love to get a lawyer's letter from him saying, stop using my picture, so we at least could find out who he is. But think about it, your video camera, your boombox, a radio, your computer, you're playing music from MP3 files or whatever, but you see all these things, they're all together on one device. And then we started to see stuff like this. Small and medium businesses spending more on social media than print. I see more and more video on small business sites nowadays than I did before. Interviews of owners, interviews of customers, that kind of thing. It's a really important way to use that. And then this group, the marketing automation folks, this is really, really quite different. And when you start looking at how it's affecting the selection of a chief marketing officer and their emphasis on statistics and analytics, these companies, if you don't know who they are, don't be afraid to raise your hand. How many of you have not heard of any of these companies? Because what? You didn't open the book. Everybody read the book and saw the logos. You're not alone, because every time I've gone out to a printer audience and I ask them if they've ever heard of these companies who are taking away their budget, they've never heard of them. And if anything, many of them should be using their services in their business. Some of these companies sell enterprise licenses, and they sell them to advertising agencies, and they resell these services to their customers. So marketing automation, which has produced these companies $7.5 billion of company value, and some publicly traded companies like Marketo. Neolane was purchased by Adobe, which is now part of the Adobe marketing suite. This is the way marketing is changing. Much like we said in Disrupting the Future, communications logistics is a really, really big problem, and marketing automation software goes into doing that, measuring it, and allowing for reallocation and changes to campaigns very, very quickly when they go out. Then, of course, I run into something else that you've seen, I've mentioned earlier, and I really see it in action, at the AMA. If you were born after 1982, you've never worked in an economic boom because you're 18 years old when it was 2000 when the last one ended. So you're just coming out to the marketplace, which means you don't know what it's like to be in a company with extremely, extremely high growth, where budgets are a little looser, where you can have some freedom to do some things or try some things out. So unless you're in some Silicon Valley companies, you don't know what this is like. So you're looking at print always as an expense, not as a cost. An expense is just some money outflow. A cost is something you expect something to get back from. You're expecting everything you do to have some kind of immediate return, because that's the culture that you're being raised in corporately. And then, if you're born after 1990, you don't remember anything without the internet. But you don't even have to be born after 1990. You just have to work sometime after 1990 or be in college during this period. So you don't have that experience that many of us have with print, of either relying on it, liking it, expecting it, whatever. The people who are now in product management or in communications management do not have this kind of relationship. So when we send old, bald, gray-haired salespeople out to the marketplace telling them how great print is, it doesn't make a good impression. And I've been told this many times, that they don't take the printing industry seriously when they're having communications discussions. Because it always goes back, you can get me started too. I miss graphic arts film. I miss diffusion transfer and phototype setting. I miss those things, really. So the idea was we have to kind of discard the past because the past is not attractive to the audience we're trying to cultivate. So hence the name of the book, and hence our fake cover that we got to get us in the mood, where instead of disrupting the future with the visit to the first press in England or whatever that was with the king holding the tablet, we wanted to call it discarding the past and have this picture. But then we realized it would go over like a lead balloon with the first audience I ever showed it to. That's you. So we came up with this. We're working from now out, and we're going to ask printers to start thinking about 2018 and 2020 and then figure out how they got there from the point where they are today. That's a very, very common strategic practice, but many printers don't have time to go through that. We also wanted to capture the cultural differences of print and media today to inform printers about that, and explain how our history is not helping us. Our history doesn't matter. What are you doing to give me ROI today? And how can you make all the other stuff I do more profitable? So print is viewed as a new perspective. They're not viewing it as something that I used to do because they've never done it as a manager. Very few of them have actually participated in substantial print campaigns. And here they are as managers or directors of communications in growing companies in the Raleigh, North Carolina area. One of our first tools in explaining it is to use the rear view mirror. So if you see it in the rear view mirror and you're using that for your planning, that's not helping you drive forward. Rear view mirror, you want to see stuff that you're quickly leaving behind, like some of the relatives you see on Thanksgiving. You want to make sure that the distance between you and is growing with them. Some of you have that family, right? Yeah. Right, you know, all know what Thanksgiving is. It's the holiday where everyone is thankful that you only see some of those people once a year. And that we're going to move forward, and the past decisions are not something you put in the past totally, but you have to figure out how to grow out of it. So consolidation, again, is one way of doing that, and alliance is the way of doing that, too. So we don't have a mainstream printing business anymore, and I'm really concerned that a lot of folks still look at, oh, print is mainstream. No, it's not. Print is now a specialty business in the minds of the new decision makers of communications budgets. It's something special that you do. It's not something that you do all the time. There are numerous ways to survive and be very, very profitable in this business. I've seen it. I've seen companies with 20% bottom lines over the last year who are doing some amazing things And with short-run stuff, they realize they have to get lots of volume in order to do that. But they're really into what their customers are doing. They understand why people print. They understand the purpose of campaigns. They understand where they're going to go, why they're going to do it, and how it fits in with the other media. Those are the really, really good printers today. So what do we do in this book that's different? Well, first, there's only one chapter on data. I know that's going to upset a lot of people. So there's only one chapter that has any data in it. And we discuss the topics of marketing analytics, marketing automation, that you should build a new business no matter how good your current business is, why transitions are risky. I've seen lots of printers really mess this part up because they don't. Once they either merge or try to start a new business, they really get into trouble trying to manage both of them. You can't do that. We tell owners in here that one of the things you may want to consider is taking some kind of employment test and measure it against other people because you may not be qualified to run the new business. And that's a sign that you should be looking elsewhere for it. It doesn't mean that you can't own the new business. The man in the chair is the, you know the classic ad that was in McGraw-Hill in 1958, the man in the chair, the grumpy guy, looks like he needs Metamucil. Oh, I don't know your company. I don't know what you stand for. I don't know. So we go back to that. That was the theme in Getting Business. We go here and explain that every single one of those questions from the man in the chair about your company, your reputation, your customers, your products, and all that can be answered by anyone in Google without having to even call you into the office to ask you those questions. So selling has changed dramatically. And that's why small businesses really, really need our discipline, they need our workflow, and they need our business insights. But we have to develop those for our business ourselves. So the bottom lines of the book are that print is part of media overall. We can't think of it as one. One of the purposes of print is to expand the use of digital media, as strange as that seems. The decision for media is complex and it goes across all business sizes. Even the decision of what kind of vehicle wrap we're going to need and what our Facebook page should look like. We have a lot of capital locked up in equipment that's not being used often. And you also know my saying that if you don't use equipment often, it lasts longer, right? And that's, you don't want that problem with presses and stuff on the floor. You've got to get rid of it and free that capital. There's a new strategic way to look at business alliances. We've always used print brokers. We've always used other trade printers to help us out. We need strategic alliances because capital in our industry is scarce, and the skills are not necessarily in our business. But we can use alliances to build toward new businesses that we might create in 3 or 5 years, right, with that focus on 2020. And then the sense that return on investment is important for communications. No one measures return on investment the same way. It used to be, did you like the print job? Yes, and that was it was satisfactory. That's not the way it's done anymore. I asked at an event a few months ago, printers, if they would work solely on the returns that a print job generated to the people who got it. Right? Meaning that if they got a direct mail campaign, if they worked on that, what the dollar returns were if it met certain goals. And none of them said that they would do that. None of them would do a print job for free and just do it for improved ROI. And then I explained to them, they've been doing that all along. Because when people decide to change their media mix, they're making decisions about what worked in the past, what will work in the future. And I think they started to think about it in a different way. What kind of value are we doing other than good resolution and nice images and great shrink wrap, you know? So it made them think quite differently. I also ran into a printer who does do printing for free and developed a campaign to develop sales leads for an industry. And they've been doing a mailing for years and years and years, and they charge independent salespeople, I think it's like $75 or $90 per sales lead. And they've got like a 90% gross margin on this print business. Never charging anyone for print, but selling the results of the communication with the marketplace. So with that, I want to invite you to some book signings today. The first one is at Veritiv at 1272, and that will start at 10:30. I know some people are going to try to get me to sign some books here. We can do that, or as we're walking up the escalator. My handwriting is bad. You won't notice where I sign. And then we're going to do it at Kodak. I'm going to try to start the Kodak one a little early since I have a flight that I have to get out to later today. But the good news is I keep hearing my flight is delayed by 2 hours. I don't know whether to trust it or not. So I may have to leave the show floor by about 1:30. I've pre-signed some books up at Kodak, and Richard will be there to sign. You know, cross out my name and write my name. I'm the one who really wrote the book. All right, so it's available on Amazon. This book that's here at the show, Color Insides, and a dimensionally printed cover, that's not the book that you get from Amazon. So this is a very, very special printing, and I want to thank Kodak and Veritiv for making all of that possible. But you can go and get it on Kindle. So I'll put those back up, and then we're going to have our one-minute break,
and
then our Q&A. So thank you very, very much for coming, and make sure you have questions.